Well, we're now turning to agenda paper 20, which deals with the classification of liability. In September, you asked us to develop a general approach to the classification of liabilities that's based on an assessment of the arrangements in existence at the reporting date. And the first section of the paper just gives background to the issue, including the outreach conducted. The general approach itself is discussed in paragraphs 27 to 37. And in that section, we compare the requirements of 69D of the standard for the classification of the liability as current with the guidance in paragraph 73 of the standard that deals with non-current classification. Now, in our analysis, the characteristics that these paragraphs have in common is that an entity is not required to settle non-current liabilities within the next 12 months. And that principle is explicit in paragraph 72 of the standard and is also similar to the classification requirements for current and non-current assets in paragraph 66 of the standard. The first question we have for you then on page 9 is, do you agree that classification of a liability as non-current depends on whether there is a contractual arrangement in existence at the reporting date, whereby the entity will not be required to settle the liability within the next 12 months? Or have you got any comments or queries on the analysis?
I had some comments on the examples in Appendix B. First, I'd like to say I agree with the analysis and the thought process that you've developed here, April. I think it's sound, and I think it's going to lead to more consistency and understanding about these types of arrangements, better information to the users, more representationally faithfulness in terms of what really is current and non-current. The scenarios that I caught my eye were number 4. They aren't listed, but it's the fourth box in Appendix C. The entity is in compliance with all terms of the arrangement and has an arrangement at the reporting date to roll over the loan with the same lender. But you don't say in your fact pattern for how long.
Right. Okay.
So that would color my answer.
That should say 12 months.
Okay.
Greater than 12 months.
Then I'm fine with that. Then the one that really gets me is, number 6. The entity has an arrangement at the reporting date to roll over the loan with the same lender, but is in breach of the conditions of the loan arrangement. A 12-month waiver of the breach of condition is obtained before the reporting date. I think you need disclosure of that. It's critical. I'm assuming that would be an automatic disclosure, but...
It's relevant, right?
Well, he's in breach and he got a waiver. That I think is important because the terms of mine, which you're making this non-current disclosure, I think have to be understood, and it's different than as if you were in compliance. Those are the two. Now the other question I have is this, and I was going back to look at IS 37 on this topic, and that is. I'm back in paragraph 91. Where you're in a situation where...
Are we thinking ahead?
Oh, I'm sorry.
Question one. Okay, all right.
Just answer question one, and then we'll go through the various components.
As I said, I have no problem with the... I agree.
Does anyone object to the basic classification principles?
Chuck?
I did. Basically disagree. When we discussed this issue, we made an outreach and what is the current practice and what you think. And based on those opinions, we made a proposal that only the same lender on the same or similar terms. And this is consistent with the derecognition's idea. I understand that it would introduce complex for the only the classification, and I understand that the classification and the recognition and derecognition is a different issue. However, if we allow everything with only focusing on cash settlement to be presented in the non-current, it would be too loose. So if you have commitment to extend that loan with completely different conditions. The nature of the loan itself is completely different. And that would mask the fact that that company is facing the, will face the financial difficulty. So in this sense, I would like to stick to the original proposal.
Can I just say that the, I'm not aware of the details, I must admit, because I wasn't following the project then, but the original proposal linking this with derecognition, the outreach that we conducted generally was very unfavorable to that, and people seem to think that there would be a number of practical issues mm-hmm. in linking the derecognition criteria of financial
assistance. But principally, I don't think, I need to go back and what the outcome was, but as far in my jurisdiction, so this is very important discipline. So I may be wrong, but but based on those outreach and we discussed in IFRIC, and that this similar term is one of the important factors. So I don't think it is a good idea to remove this important element only for the reasons of the practical.
Tertia?
Talk. I don't think your concern is really relevant to question one. I think it's your concern is more relevant to issues that come later in the paper to what constitutes a settlement within 12 months or not. So are you comfortable with the general principle?
General principle is fine.
Question one, right?
General principle is fine, but
okay.
So we have agreement on the general principle as formulated in question one. So go on.
The paper then considers a series of detailed amendments that are proposed, and although these proposed changes are all bundled into question 3 on page 26, we think it might be easier to discuss and vote on each separately as we go along. So the first of these is that on pages 10 to 12, we deal with the use of conditional in terms of the entity having an unconditional right to defer settlement. We think and we said in the paper that rights are rarely unconditional in practice, and so we propose deleting that word from paragraph 69D of the standard. Do you agree with the proposal to delete unconditional from the right?
What will happen with a conditional right?
We look subsequently at the paper as what the effects of the conditions are at the year end and how we would deal with that. So basically, subsequently in the paper, we say that you look at it from the perspective of what the position is of satisfying the conditions as at the reporting date.
I'll hold my comments for a moment.
Okay. I think we have an agreement here.
We agree with conditional. The second question is, I think that some find the use of discretion in paragraph 73 of the standard confusing, because right is used in the discussion in paragraph 69D. We think that management discretion is actually better described as a right, the only condition of which being the entity's will to act on it. So we propose that discretion in paragraph 73 is replaced by right to avoid that confusion. Do you agree with that proposal? Yes?
I do.
Okay. We propose also clarifying that the settlement of the liability should be based on the transfer of resources, and that's discussed in paragraphs 57 to 70 of the paper. Mm-hmm. Now, the effect of referring to deferred settlement in paragraph 69D of the standard is to defer a cash outflow, and the effect of refinancing or rollover on paragraph 73 of the standard is that one liability replaces another. So in neither case is there a cash outflow for at least 12 months. The basis of conclusion also refers to an earlier IFD conclusion that classifying a liability on the requirements to transfer cash is a better indication of liquidity and solvency. We do note in the paper, however, that liabilities are defined in terms of an outflow of resources. And although the transfer of non-cash items is less common, We propose using the wording settlement by the transfer of cash or other assets to cover those instances. We think that there are several advantages to using settlement by the transfer of cash or other assets. A transfer of cash or other asset is readily identifiable and it's a clearly defined event. Information about obligations required for each transfer of cash or other assets useful to investors. And specifying settlement by the transfer of cash or other assets takes the tension off whether the replacement liability is with the same lender or whether it's on similar terms. So the question is, we also talk about, by the way, net settlement in this section to make it clear that there's a transfer of resources in that case, even if the physical transfer of cash or asset is offset by another transaction. So the question is, do you agree to including by the transfer of cash and other assets with settlement to clarify that settlement is a liability, or do you have any comments on that proposal?
April, a comment just, and I apologize, this just came to me as you were walking through this, so I'm going to throw out a problem without a suggestion for how to address it, which is, I think we have to go back and think about items that are classified as liabilities because they're settled in a variable number of shares, because an entity's own shares would not fall under either cash or other assets, and those items could be due for settlement within the 12-month period. So while fundamentally I agree with your notion of focusing on the transfer of cash or other assets, I think we have to consider what we do about variable number of shares obligations here, because I would not want to exclude them.
Okay.
Let's just take that as a note.
I'll talk with you separately about that, because I had thought that the 2007 and 2009 amendments were actually dealing with that, but
because it just came to me as you were introducing it. I can't swear to sound true.
I just would like to have a question about rollover to the same lender on a different term in your paragraph 78 to 81. And I'm not 100% persuaded by your argument until in the paragraph 81. You are saying that in classifying liability, we do not think that it is the terms of the loan that is relevant. So why not?
Okay. Have we finished, therefore, with questions?
This is the next question.
Oh, sorry.
Again.
I didn't think they...
Are we all done on the question of transfer of cash and other assets?
Mm-hmm.
Fine.
Yep.
Okay. Paragraph 81. I suppose really what the entire principle that we're basing it on is when you're looking at classifying the liability at the reporting date, when will you have to repay that principle? Is it going to be in 12 months, or is it going to be greater than 12 months? And we're saying that for the purposes of classification, that's really all that we're relying on. To the extent that there are different terms and conditions associated with the borrowings, that will be disclosed in that disclosure, and so that information will be available to people. But that for just deciding where you put it on the statement of financial position, it's really the sort of the future liquidity and solvency and when you're going to settle that we think is the key thing for that basic classification between current and non-current. Obviously, within current, the borrowings will have different characteristics and that will need to be disclosed. And within non-current, there may well be different characteristics and that will need to be disclosed. But it's really just that.
But let's suppose that I have the right to roll over, refinance, but the lender can change the terms at will. Effectively, the lender can deny me the finance by just increasing the interest rate sufficiently that there's no way that I would want to refinance.
Well, yes, but you aren't required to settle that liability. You could keep that liability unsettled for a year.
probability of settlement.
And it would, you know, you would disclose in your notes on the borrowings to say, I have taken out this facility with no control over the terms and conditions, so I may not find it sustainable. I mean, I think it would be a rather extreme position.
I think it would be a rather normal position if you are a bad company.
Yes.
Squeeze them out, get rid of them as soon as possible.
Yeah.
Raise their interest 10%.
Yes, exactly.
That's why I think this unconditional makes sense.
Then nothing is ever long term.
Yeah. Of course. I have a loan agreement and it says that I'm paying LIBOR plus 5% and I have the right to add another 12 months. But if the bank can charge me LIBOR plus 10% 6 months down the road, I don't think this is something I can just unconditionally.
But how would an entity in that position actually physically settle that loan?
If you pay it back.
Where would it get the money from?
From another bank.
And at what percentage would it have to pay that?
I don't know. If I'm the banker, I don't care.
It's a right that's worthless. I have a right to refinance, but the bank can just choose whatever terms they want. So is the right actually worth anything to me?
That's why the unconditional is important in my mind.
I mean, the unconditional bit is a problem because that kind of rules out anything, and that's, I think, why we're trying to remove unconditional. But just saying there's a right seems to me...
We've retained the idea of management expectation, and we do say in the paper that management expectation should be taken into account.
Okay.
So is this a case where we would say that management expectation would override that? Because management would not reasonably expect to continue with that agreement, even though they just have the agreement in place.
I think that's useless. Management's intent on a thing like this is of no value to me.
Economic substance?
I think this is a really important matter. If people think you have your financing arranged for the long term and it's not current, I think you can make severe mistakes on what will happen with the company.
Are we just concerned about situations where we don't know what the terms will be when we exercise that right to renew? Because if we do know what the terms are, then isn't April's point relevant, but it's also management's expectations that you know that the terms on which you're entitled to renew are going to be a doubling of the interest rate or a tripling of the interest rate. Then, you know, management may decide, well, actually, I've got no alternative. I need to take that. Otherwise, I need to liquidate, in which case, with him, talking about a not going concern basis. In which case, you know, that is simply the consequence.
I don't know if I'm wrong on this, but aren't we solving more problems than we were set to solve? I thought we had this with, you have the end of the reporting period and I don't have my things arranged and I agree a month later before I publish my report, and we said, okay, let's see if we can come to a solution with that. And I think if we fix that and we leave the rest, we are not creating new problems. But as we are reviewing this now rather more comprehensively.
I don't think that was the problem. I think the problem was actually that people were uncertain where you had conditions, what would happen in breach subsequently. That was the real problem. And it's really the effect of after date events or change of the conditions after date the concern.
Well, that's all these two matters and leave the rest. But each time we are changing a word, we are changing people's view on how to read it. We'll get a new question of fixing interpretations or clarifications on this.
But people think it's difficult to actually solve it without addressing both of the paragraphs, because people see the paragraphs as being contradictory. The guidance on when it's current is you have an unconditional right. The guidance for when it's non-current is when you have management's discretion. And those are two very different sort of levels of rights or triggers for the classification decision.
It is important that the solution that we have here is a consistent one, a sort of coherent one. And I think that is what, you know, yes, we've got a number of things we've been looking at here, but to ensure that we've got that coherency.
Gary?
Actually, I have a different point I want to raise, but I'm inclined to agree. I think the terms are relevant. I mean, I know you were trying to get away from substantially similar terms and be a little bit more expansive, but I think there's an inference, you know, that the lending facility is not so draconian. You know, we allow them to use it. They do acknowledge that Manchin's intent is relevant here, which I agree with that. So, but if it's so draconian, and rational people would probably not use it and leave liability incurrent, but you can't necessarily count on everybody, you know, seeing it that way. Mm-hmm. So I'm inclined to think, you know, on similar, substantially similar, relevant, updated, you know, for current conditions, you know, we might have a 10-year-old facility that's expiring and no one would write it today, you know, as you would say before the financial crisis. So I'm inclined to think terms are relevant. We need to modify it or at least amplify it, as the case may be. When we talk and we talk about the same lender, I mean, how narrow or tight are you envisioning that? When you think of these multinational banks, you know, might lend through individual different subsidiaries and the current loans with some multinational bank through their London office, but they're offering the replacement through their Hong Kong office. But that would be a different legal entity inside the larger lender. So if you wanted to read it really, really tight, it would have to be the same legal entity inside the larger lender. And I think the answer could go either way. I just think you need to clarify intent. And I think someplace in here, I don't know if it's in this section or someplace else, you talked about also a consortium of lenders. Now, members of consortiums also tend to change. And would that be viewed? You know, you got a lead underwriter or a lead, you know, principal to it, you know, but if the members of the consortium are changing, even if the essence, the agreement is the same, again, I envision that question coming up in your feedback.
And, I mean, all we've said in the paper is that consortiums do change. The members of consortiums do change. And you would have to apply judgment as to whether or not you thought that was the same consortium that actually, and that you take into account factors, and one of the factors would be, is the lead bank still the same person?
So this is, or a majority of the bank forces.
Yeah, this is still viewed as a short-term part of, you know,
yeah.
Actually, you and I have discussed, actually have different opinion of could the lending facility be a different organization if it's guaranteed, fixed, committed, and just happens to be a better deal than your current lender. I don't necessarily agree that that would put them in the current. I understand the gross cash flows, but I think as long as this is just a sort of a short-term quick fixes project, we'll leave it as it is. But if they take it to a larger project, I'd like to talk some more about that.
Okay. If we're concerned about similar terms, how the loan is rolled over to the same lender on similar terms, are those similar absolute terms or market similar terms? So, I mean, for example, if you're currently, so it's market similar, so that if interest rates generally have gone up,
no,
you'd expect your interest rate. Jan doesn't.
I say no.
No, it would have to be
predetermined somehow. I mean, if you take the financial crisis, I mean, perhaps better and not better, but I mean, some banks just kicked customers out. Mm-hmm. As soon as possible, get rid of them. And whatever means you take, and if that is the situation, you cannot say that this is anything but current.
And that's why they usually have these relative requirements to begin with, to be able that if push comes to shove and they are confronted with a financial crisis or something, that they can just push customers out as quickly as possible.
Yeah, but that is not an unconditional right to prolong the arrangement.
But it's not unconditional, because there will be conditions.
Yeah, and I mean, there are situations like the main shareholder holds 30% of the shares, and if he goes below 30%, the terms are changing or the promise is cancelled. A lot of things that can happen around this.
So how many people think that we need to include something along the lines of on same or similar terms?
All?
Same or similar terms.
Yeah.
Majority, okay.
How do you address this with a 30% shareholder? If he says 1%, the promise is cancelled. It's a condition for the rollover possibility that he remains as a shareholder.
Yes.
When do you catch that?
Well, what we're basically saying is that if he's a shareholder at the year end, then you're in agreement with the covenant, so you would treat it as...
Well, no, because he's got to be a shareholder in a year's time. To be able to get funds, they've got to remain a shareholder for another year or not sell at 1%. So you can't say you've complied with it at the year end?
I think you have complied with it at the year end. At the year end, you're in compliance with the terms and conditions.
So that's a very important condition for to get the renewal.
Yes.
And April, that's where I fall off a bit, because, well, I agree with your analysis in the paper that keeping unconditional in is a problem, and I think it is, because I think we would have nothing as non-current. If we, either we tie ourselves in knots about conditionality, but any loan that has a material adverse change clause in it, is conditional, and that you cannot say I am in control of my destiny for the next 12 months. I think we've got to find a way to deal with unconditionality.
So if a covenant was not under the control of the entity,
adverse condition.
Yeah. So what I'm saying is I think you're right to plan to remove I was going to say I agree with your recommendation to remove conditionality. What I am struggling with, however, is when you get to the next section, and I know I'm cheating a bit, but it's the IS-10 event after the balance sheet date. I think we've kind of swung to such a narrow, what conditions do I have at the balance sheet date, that's all I'm focused on, that we haven't maybe thought enough about how IS-10 looks at some events after the balance sheet date. For example, it says if you have bad debts after the balance sheet date, you have to consider whether that's just the manifestation of conditions that existed at the balance sheet date. And frankly, if you don't have a breach of the terms at 31st December, but you breach them on 15th of January, absent an unusual event in between, I would bet that the breach on January is just when the calculation is due, et cetera, not for something that happened after the balance sheet date. So, well, I generally support your approach. I think we have to be more nuanced in terms of some of the situations that IS-10 brings in terms of saying, are things that notionally happened after the balance sheet date actually evidence of conditions that existed at the balance sheet date itself? And we need to find a way to work that in, because what I'm coming back to, and this is maybe a difference from Jan's view, is I think we just have to acknowledge that there's judgment both in terms of whether the terms of a facility are the same or similar, and we may have to bring in some judgment about whether events after the balance sheet date are indicative of conditions that existed at the balance sheet date.
Although most of the sorts of conditions that we're generally talking about here are sort of absolute conditions, so things like gearing percentages, even though that may change subsequently, the condition at the year end would be absolute, and shareholdings, the condition would be absolute. It wouldn't be a change. It wouldn't be further information about the condition at the reporting date. It would be a change in those conditions. So I'm not sure that there are that many areas where you have to wait a few months to know more about the conditions that are relevant to security, the security of the borrowing. I just can't think of an example particularly, or certainly one that we've discussed today,
but
where something after the balance sheet date would give you more information about what happened at the balance sheet.
But if we did apply 10 and it did give us information, that would change the classification, wouldn't it? Just the way it would change the measurement on receivables.
And I think what I'm just trying to say is you've written, especially when we get to the next section, building on the point we were discussing in paragraph 81. So when you talk about how you apply IAS 10 to the position you're suggesting in 81, it takes a very, has it occurred by the state, absolute, iron wall. And I think we've got to bring in some of the nuance in IAS 10.
And I mean, in paragraph 90, we do say that an event that provides more information about the conditions would be an adjusting event.
Right.
One that...
Right, and
wouldn't be.
Yeah. So that, because when you're sitting at December 31st and you say, okay, maybe based on my position at December 31st, I haven't blown my gearing covenant, but I know I have to make X payment January 15th, and that means I'm going to blow it and I'm going to be in breach, in 3 weeks. It probably points to a shortfall in lack of resources that is just at the balance sheet date.
So what we're saying is we're not negating the requirements in IAS 10.
Right.
That normal approach of IAS 10 would still apply here to this classification assessment.
Well, if we were saying, I mean, at the moment in IAS 10, knowing that you were in breach 10 days after the year end, I don't think would be an adjusting event.
I think you'd have to assess what's driving you to knowing that you're going to breach it in 10 days.
Right. But if you did breach it in 10 days, A clearer example, I think, is Mary started with, you learned that you had more bad debts than you thought shortly after year end, and so you go back and you adjust your receivables balance. That would change your working capital ratios, which might violate the covenants retroactively, which would change your classification.
I was looking just to that general guidance that 10 tells you record that at 31st December. But.
So how many of you think that if you were in breach of the conditions between reporting date and then authorizing the financial statements for issue, that then that would render
you have to apply 10 and consider whether the subsequent breach is evidence of conditions that existed at the balance sheet date. It's not automatic on or automatic off.
You apply 10 in this analysis, and I think all Mary is saying is that you missed part of 10, which is the gray ones, and bring those into the discussion as well. You chose to do the easy ones in 10, the black and white ones, and she says there are some gray ones, and you should bring those in as well.
They've kind of jumped ahead to the issue that I wanted to talk about. But can I raise two questions here? Because I want to test my understanding of the arms concern about the same lender. And I want to, ask Jan the following question. Jan, would you prefer to have a loan classified as current versus non-current if you are refinancing with the same lender but on materially different terms? So you want that current or non-current? Same lender, but materially different terms. You're going to have the right to refinance. It'll be more than 12 months.
Current.
You want that current?
Yeah. If it's another loan.
Okay. I'm fine with that.
And you've already signed the agreement before the balance sheet date. It's locked up. It's in place. I's dotted, T's crossed.
But it's not the same loan if it's material.
Okay. In my mind, it's not the same loan.
Okay. And those would have to be identical terms, no variation.
No. Well, I'd say it's identical, but
different.
Like you said, for example, LIBOR plus 0.5%. And then if LIBOR goes up 5%, then you understand what it is. I mean, the terms are set like that. But it's not that the bank can sort of go from LIBOR plus 0.5% to LIBOR plus 8%. They shouldn't be allowed to kick me out.
How about if the market changes so everybody's going from LIBOR plus 3% to LIBOR plus 12%?
Well, that's my benefit because I signed an agreement with them. I'm only paying 0.5%.
Sorry?
I signed a long-term agreement, and I set my terms. That's why we call it non-current.
The only thing you even in that circumstance, being considered current.
Yeah. Okay. So it has to be identical, not just varying.
Basically, the same terms.
Yes.
Same thing.
Same
as similar. I think you have if you have a LIBOR plus 0.5%, and it's a 5-year agreement, and I can 12 months, I can sort of confirm that I will keep the loan. Then I think it's non-current. But if the bank can change my terms like that, sorry guys.
Yeah, I think I agree with you.
If the bank can change the spread over LIBOR, no, we all accept that LIBOR can change and therefore change. Yeah.
And I necessarily think if they can, just the bank can unilaterally change terms, it's not much of a contract. it's usually a bilateral agreement.
So your right has no economic substance, actually, at the end of the day.
And I suppose that is, as I said before, that's probably the case with a lot of these rollover terms.
Yeah. But, I mean, there's similar and substantially similar without being the same, but let's say in your current loan, this is the end of a 3-year, window, and say if I roll over 5 years, well, that's substantially different, but I don't think people would view that as a bad thing, so I think it's similar, substantially similar, and arguably it's only the downside you're worrying about. It could be substantially better.
So April, are you on the subject of effects of events after the reporting period yet?
Yeah, let's go for it.
Okay.
It's become simple.
Okay. Yeah. So finally, we are at the part of the paper that considers the effect of classification of breaches of the system and of events after the reporting date. Really, many of the problems and diversity in applying 69D have arisen because of the different interpretations. we've summarized in paragraph 88 what we think to be summary of previous decisions and notes on the basis tells us about the effect of breach and conditions. And then in 89 and 90, as we said, we talk about IS-10, what the guidance is from there. And so, the paper does focus on the fact pattern as at the reporting date, and classification should be based on the entity's rights at the reporting date. And the entity's compliance with conditions of that date. So we propose adding at the reporting date to deferring settlement in paragraph 94 of the paper. And we've got the table in paragraph 91, which gives a couple of fact patterns on what we think would be the effect. And as Pat mentioned earlier, we've got more examples in Appendix B. So, questions, Pat, on the examples?
I guess the question with respect to two issues. One is, I guess, more of a disclosure issue. Let's say you obtain the waiver, as you indicate in paragraph 88A, before the reporting date. So you have a breach, but you get a waiver. Would any of the guidance here or in any other parts of IFRS require that disclosure to a material contract? To me, that's a change in material terms. So I would think disclosure would be required. I just want to confirm whether you agree with that.
I think disclosure would be required at the moment. I think I'm assuming disclosure would be required under IFRS 7.
Right, okay. So the next question is, with respect to those scenarios in 91B, where you have compliance, but you expect to be in breach now 6 months after the reporting date. As Mary said, I mean, if this is a known condition, today, you'll be in breach. The question, I guess, is how do you actually apply that? Do you say that's not a condition at the balance sheet date, the reporting date, because it's going to happen 6 months hence? I'm thinking about the guidance in IAS 37 that deals with future events, and when you know a future event is going to have an effect on the measurement, it usually says to take that into consideration. So I'm struggling here with the guidance that you come up with. You say, if in breach before issue is authorized, disclose the effect of breach on classification. But I'm just wondering, you know, whether non-current is really the right, you know, outcome there. That doesn't feel right to me.
And I suppose it's because generally, when we're preparing financial statements, we don't anticipate what might be a change in characteristics in the future. We are reporting the elements as they are at the reporting date. So although I think from a sort of perspective of prudence or what have you, people are uncomfortable with the idea of you may well be in breach in the future, and it may well be likely that you're going to be in breach, but that doesn't really tell you what the classification was at the reporting date.
Is your interpretation of the word expect here? Because expectations in letters in example B and C, for me, when I was reading the same line as Pat, it says, if I do already expect today, I felt a little bit uncomfortable in having this as non-current.
Also, and this is where the nuances become important, because it seems to me that if you expect something to happen in 6 months, the circumstances giving rise to that something happening
you know
in 6 months have probably already happened. They're probably already present.
Exactly.
Yeah, the other point, though, is I would have thought 59A would have kicked you out anyway. Because if you expect to fail the breaches, then you probably expect to if you expect to breach, you probably expect to settle liability in your normal operating plan.
Right. Okay.
Because it's the two expectations that are coming in. So I think it's more a I think the saving is wrong rather than the outcome is wrong.
Isn't it related to what Mary was saying before about the analysis under 10? You have to look at what causes that expectation, and if it's something that has occurred at the balance sheet date, then you would reflect it. If it's something that you expect to happen.
Yeah.
But as Daryl was saying, let's say you expect to have too little cash flow 6 months from now. You have it today. But the conditions that are in place to produce that too little cash flow 6 months from now. So I think, you know, that's
I think in many circumstances, if you're expecting something to happen in 6 months, it's because something has happened now to tell you that's what. So it might be a drop in sales, it might be a drop in cash collections, it might be something like that.
And so the next question is, so I'm management and I'm going to classify my debt as current because I think I expect that I'll be in a breach 6 months from now, then shouldn't he be disclosing that he expects that and why he expects that so analysts know that, oh my God, he's not going to have sales? So where do we stop here?
Well, you wouldn't stop there.
Yeah, exactly.
You would. I think you'd have to give that information because, to my mind, that's a condition that's known at the balance sheet date. Let's say I have a patent.
No, it's not known. It's expected.
No, let's say I have a patent that's going to expire in 6 months from now, which will cause a significant drop in sales, significant drop in working capital. I won't have enough liquidity to make an interest payment. But as of today, you know, I passed the test.
I think my second point there is that I think that's irrelevant anyway, because I think that 69A kicks you out of this before you even get to that spot. 69A simply says, if I expect to be in breach, then I expect that I'm going to settle this within my operating cycle, then surely it is current even before I start worrying about whether the event has actually happened or not. I have an expectation on this.
But there could be other remedies to the breach that you might be able to put into place in 6 months' time, which could avoid having to repay. So it may be that you then are able to renegotiate with the same lender.
But you don't have those rights today.
You don't, but neither are you in breach today.
Okay. So is it a minimum package of information, the disclosure of that we should insist on here? I mean,
but don't we go too far, Ima? This is not about forward-looking information about management's expectation of forward-looking. And that is disclosure of a current situation where you think, okay, your liabilities are. And I understand all that, but during this topic now to get in all this kind of stuff,
if we were talking about measurement, we wouldn't let management change the measurement of the reporting date to take into account downturns or upturns in future trade.
Right.
But for some reason we think that because of classification, we should let subsequent change in the characteristics of the element change how we classify it. And at the moment, I'm still slightly perplexed as to why that is.
Ringo?
I've got a feeling, you know, the discussion is valid, you know. I'm not sure, you know, if we confirm some of the ideas, whether those discussions should be in this standard or surely or some kind of link, you know. We briefly said when you make assessment about the classification, you should, you know, take into consideration of the requirement in text. That's all. It seems not clear for me.
Yeah, and I think that's what I heard from a number of people here, that actually if you expect to breach in 6 months, you need to apply the approach in IAS 10 to work out, well, what does that tell you about conditions at the balance sheet date, and has the underlying event that's going to cause the breach actually already occurred?
But do we have similar issues in all of the other items? Not only liability, or current or non-current. If that is the case, should we have similar discussions in IS-1?
No, I think here we're talking about sort of making sure we keep the link, we remind people of the link to IS-10.
Yeah, I understand that, you know, in all of other balance sheet income items, same items, I would feel we have similar issues about the impact of the people event, which based on 10 will be either as adjusted or not adjusted, or can also highlight the disclosure requirements. My question is, this is why I say that discussion is valid. And the question from me is, should we keep silent at all, or have a comprehensive or very solid discussion, or just linkage?
Well, are you maybe saying, for the same reason that I think we have the discussion about impairment of in IS-10 rather than in IS-1, were you asking whether or not some of this discussion about subsequent events should actually be put into IS-10? And keep IS-1 as saying, focus on events and conditions at the balance sheet date, but don't forget to consider IS-10. Is that what you were just suggesting?
No, I'm not sure. This is why my question is, I say the discussion is valid, and then we have three choices. It is not clear for me, you know. First one is, we not touch 10 at all in this standard. A second choice is, have some kind of reference, you know. But my concern is, not only in this particular area, in any of the items in balance sheet and income statement, we all have similar issues. And should we then?
We don't address all of those in this project.
Yeah. Agreed.
Yeah.
Too broad.
Let me finish, you know. And the last one is, we have comprehensive discussions here.
Alan?
More or less to this, I think we're almost trying to develop a principle here, and I thought it was actually supposed to be the opposite. I thought the principle was that you classify something that has to be settled within 12 months as current. Now, there's an exception, and the exception is
if you're able to roll it over, refinance on similar terms. And so it is actually quite valid to constrain that exception. And so we can think slightly differently around this, because we don't want this to become a very general principle. And you know, even the way that the paragraph's written now, the one that we're, we can't find it now, but the one we're trying to change on page 18, paragraph 75, unfortunately the paragraph starts off the other way around about specifying that it's been non-current. If anything, I would have written up the whole paragraph, we'd start from scratch and saying, you shall classify as current unless, and then specify what those exceptions are. And that's, you know, it's hard to tell from drawing up from discussion, but it's almost like they have the right, and the terms are such that the entity expects to exercise that right. That would be my sort of general take on that. Mm. But I think it is appropriate to constrain this, mm-hmm. because we're creating an exception to the principle.
Agreed.
A lot of the discussion here about bringing IS 10 and others in is about trying to create a principle, which then becomes, you can analogize that and becomes quite generalizable. That, I don't know what the consequences are.
Well, just to clarify, I wasn't proposing to change anything related to 10. I like your suggestion, Alice. I think Daryl's observation is spot on. My problem with this table in 91 is I think the table doesn't reflect the principles in 10. I think Daryl's right that you would get kicked out if in the scenario I'm describing, you today you know you're going to have a patent expire in 6 months. That's a condition I know today. I think that would kick you out. So I don't think you would actually get to the scenario that you've described here. I just think the table is wrong.
The current practice, I mean, as it happens, current practice seems to be that if you expect a breach in the future, you don't anticipate that. So that at the moment, people would show this as non-current.
Even if there's a known event.
Even if they know that they're going to.
That exists at the balance sheet date.
Yes.
Is that, that's practice, or that's what IS 10 says?
That is practice.
April, could I ask, paragraph, I think, is it 69 says, IS 1 paragraph 69, an entity shall classify a liability as current when A, it expects to settle the liability, it just says in its normal operating cycle, and then C is due to be settled. And this question of expect, kind of combining A and C, are you proposing in the paper to modify the use of the word expect at all? Because some of the stuff that we're saying about what if, based on conditions at the reporting date, you expect to breach within the 12 months, does it in some ways come back to paragraph 69? And the fact that it has the word expect there. Now, it has it in A, not C.
And
I just can't remember what
there is a part in the paper where I've addressed that. The issue is that expects appears throughout
mm-hmm.
the standard. And so I was wary of going and changing anything about expectation. And so we say in the paper that we'll just keep the expectation of expectation in the standard.
Well, then I think that's the other tension or problem in terms of the recommendation to do a strict focus on the conditions at the reporting date, because if at the reporting date you have an expectation that you'll breach and you'll have to settle, that's what doesn't square.
That's what Daryl was saying.
Yeah.
69A.
Yes.
You wouldn't even get past 69A because you wouldn't be expecting to settle it. And
but I think Michael's point is cheating.
But that's not normal. You won't have a cash outflow necessarily because you've got a waiver, but that's not normal. So is that settling liability normal?
Most of what I wanted to say came up after I put up my 10 card, but I think I agree. I think the problem is probably more so the tables. I think, you know, IS 1 is fine. You've sort of taken a principle. It's an iron curtain. Either you comply or you don't comply, or you've got your extension or you don't have your extension balance sheet date. I think given the objectives of this short-term project, I don't think you can do much beyond that at this point. You know, I have my own tend to actually disagree with some of the principles of IS-1. You could argue that the issuance date is it you know, what do you do if you don't issue your statements for 6 months after it and the event's already happened that you're into? So I think they have different issues with it, but I think given the objectives of this project, I think you've done a good job with this. But I'm inclined to agree with my colleagues to write the problems might be the table in 91. That's why you know you're going to be in breach.
That table's not having any effect on what we're doing, is it? But this is just for information.
These were just examples of how you would apply.
And for the sake of this paper, not for.
I don't disagree, but they're inconsistent.
Okay, but I mean, we can discuss that for a long time, but it's not going to affect anything.
Hopefully not.
Even if we can't solve everything at this time, just eliminating diversity in practice and given clarity in itself has its own, you know, values.
Do we have clear conclusions?
Yeah.
Okay.
Oh, good. Do you expect me to be able to summarise our conclusion?
Yes.
I think we did conclude that unconditional should go, that discretion should be replaced by rights, that rollover should be with the same lender on same or similar terms.
I think it should be same, similar, or more favorable. What if you were non-investment grade when you took out your thing, you've gotten to investment grade and presumably get more favorable terms?
That's not the same loan, is it?
Well, I mean, it's not the same loan anyway. You're rolling it over to a different loan. You know, it's just a continuation of an arrangement with a lender.
We don't think they're introducing buyers.
Yep.
Neutral.
Yeah.
But
you're being prudent. Is the majority for just saying?
I don't agree. I mean, if it's better, I mean, it's your next comment's going to come. You know that saying or somewhere. If it's markedly better, I don't know why you would consider it current if you intend to refinance it.
Yeah.
You can put out for comments in there, but I suspect this will come back.
Are the majority the same or similar?
Yeah, same or similar, and more favorable.
No. Now, I think where we've got to on the final question of what's the effect of the conditions at the reporting date, I think we think that it should reflect the conditions at the reporting date, but that we need to be cognizant of the requirements of ISM and that post-balance sheet events may actually provide more information about the circumstances that existed on those conditions at the reporting date.
For this project, I'd be very careful about going too much into 10, other than saying
refer to that. And so I don't think that affects the proposed wording. We're just putting a discussion in to say 10 will tell you more.
Yeah.
I think that the way Alan summarised the possible change to paragraph 75 actually is quite helpful, because I think we've possibly wrapped up two different things in the discussion of conditions at the balance sheet date. One is, what rights does the borrower have at the reporting date? And clearly you can't go beyond that. You have to focus on the rights that actually exist. But then the second thing is, what outcome are those rights likely to have? And I think all these questions that come up about where you expect a breach in the future, I think that's more about the outcome of the rights rather than what exists at the balance sheet date. And I think we might want to look separately at those. Because the expectations are inevitably forward-looking, they have to be. And so it has to consider, I think, what management thinks will change.
What if you don't know whether it's going to change or not? So Jan's example of the major shareholder earning 30%, and it's the right to refinance is conditional on that major shareholder saying, you wouldn't know whether they will or will not sell past their 30%.
No, but on the other hand, if they told you they're going to,
we're sitting at the reporting date, they own 30%, we don't know what's going to happen in the future. Is it current or non-current?
Non-current.
I'm uncomfortable with that being non-current.
I agree. And what if you have a known outcome that's in the future?
Yeah. And that's why I'd say if you know that something that you can foresee an outcome of the right you have today that means you're going to end up paying, then I'd classify as current at that point.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So I can foresee it if it's possible, they may sell part of their holding and...
Well, that's a more difficult question then, of course. What sort of threshold do you have for those?
It's a threshold question, because if that shareholder had 85%, has held 85% for the last 10 years, and the condition is he's got to have at least 30, you might be very comfortable to have that as non-current. You're just pushing it down the threshold a bit and getting more uncomfortable as you move down.
But doesn't it also come back to the point of saying we can't solve all these and because of the number of permutations and the judgment involved, but saying if you classified it as non-current on the basis that you expect to continue meeting the condition that Jan own at least 30%, then depending upon the significance of the debt, et cetera, that becomes an item that you have to disclose because it's a significant judgment.
Yeah, well, the disclosure will be somewhere on page 82 or something in small print, and no one knows. I don't understand why do we want to call this sort of non-current? I mean, if we are in doubt, I think we should put it at current.
Mm-hmm. Well, agreed.
Yeah, I think part of the concern though is the IFRS has always had this rollover or refinancing. All we were looking to do was to clarify when rollover or refinancing comes in. We're talking about circumstances where I am in conditions, I'm fully within the conditions of the at year end, but something might change thereafter. Well, then in fact, the whole refinancing rollover, I think, goes out the window.
Yeah.
I can't think there's any circumstance where you could argue that there is no single thing that might possibly happen.
That's why I said, if we don't change what we have, I would be much more happy. If we leave the word unconditional...
Haven't we moved to... What was the word we moved to?
We took it out.
Well, if we leave unconditional in, then we're at a loss to know why you would ever treat anything as non-current.
How does it work today?
It works today because everyone interprets unconditional in a different way.
Yeah.
So some people say if management control the condition, then it's effectively unconditional.
It's diversity like that.
And that's what the problem is. And the standard itself goes on to say you have an unconditional right, but then tells you what to do if you breach the conditions in the unconditional right. So at the moment, it's very inconsistent internally.
Okay, so where were we?
I think we have to come back with something on this conditionality, don't we? The other pieces are okay, but it's this last piece.
Okay.
This brings us to the end of this month's board meeting. Thank you.